Welcome to Mirror News Now, the podcast for Henry Ford College's student newspaper, The Mirror News. I'm Catherine Warren, Editor-in-Chief. I'm excited to bring to you the second installment of the three-part series we like to call Behind the Scenes. In each segment, we will go behind the scenes at several local attractions in the Metro Detroit area. In part one last month, we visited the Library Street Collective in Detroit and the Arab American National Museum in Dearborn. This month, we feature the Henry Ford Museum of American Innovation in Greenfield Village, which is located in Dearborn, Michigan. We will begin with an interview I had with Kate Moreland, Senior Manager of Museum Programs and Exhibits at the Henry Ford Museum of American Innovation, about their latest attraction, the Disney Costume Exhibit. Do you mind just starting with introducing yourself?
Sure, I'm Kate Moreland. I'm Senior Manager of Museum Programs and Exhibits at the Henry Ford.
Great. How has this exhibit been for you guys as an opening exhibit?
This has been a really fun exhibit to open. As you're probably aware, there are many Disney fans out there, and right from day one, we just saw that enthusiasm with our guests, many of them coming in costume. So they seem to be having a lot of fun with the exhibit. And there's many recognizable costumes from especially the past 20 years. So any fans of the more recent live action films really love this exhibit.
Great. Speaking of live action, does this focus mainly on live actions? Or are fans going to see maybe some of the park costumes?
This is mainly live action, and like I said, it's mostly from the 21st century. There's some that dip back a bit farther. Okay. The oldest one is Mary Poppins costume. That was from the 1960s. But back at that time, many of the costumes were not saved. Sometimes they were even rentals. And so the Disney Archives didn't start collecting those costumes until a bit later than that. So it's really the more recent costumes that you'll see here.
Awesome. I know that the museum has held the Art of Pixar as well as Costume of Marvel. How has this experience differed from those other two Disney properties? Mm-hmm.
Well, in some ways, they're similar. Now, Pixar and Marvel, of course, were separate and then became part of Disney, so it's all one happy family now. The Pixar exhibit focused on the science behind Pixar, so it was the various different jobs that go into creating a Pixar film, and of course that's animated, so that's a little bit different. The Marvel exhibit was kind of comprehensive of the Marvel universe, and so it had some really choice costumes, but it also had sketches and multimedia and such. This exhibit is very much an object-focused exhibit, and the objects in this case being the costumes. So what you see in the exhibit is a more understated presentation and background to the costumes so that they can really shine. And I think that that was a savvy choice on Disney's part, because with these films, it's hard to get a real appreciation for the costuming with everything else that's going on. Because when you're watching the film, you're paying attention to the plot. Of course, the scenery is very immersive. And then the costume, you may get a sense of the color and the shape, but really not the details. So this exhibit allows those details and the craftsmanship to really shine.
Awesome. That sounds amazing. Is the layout of the exhibit, how is it laid out? Is it, you know, grouped by characters, since it's heroes and villains? Does it start with heroes, ends with villains?
It starts actually with Cinderella. So it's a particular character. And that character is used to show how various costume designers have influenced the look of Cinderella and her particular personality in a variety of format. that. So there's a Cinderella from Once Upon a Time that's very much different from the Cinderella with the blue dress that we're all accustomed to. The fairy godmothers are thrown in there as well, and we call that the Cinderella Workshop because that's kind of a case study of costuming. From there, the exhibit goes on into the main portion of the gallery with the villains on the left and the heroes on the right. Disney was emphatic that we would keep that division because the theme is heroes and villains. So anytime we're working with a traveling exhibit, there's a number of stakeholders, and in this case, we are a stakeholder and so is Disney. And so we laid out the exhibit with that theme. Then in the center, there's a spaces in between. So there are some characters that are a little bit bad, a little bit good. So we're talking about characters like Jack Sparrow, that he's somewhere in between a hero and a villain. And then we also have pods that juxtapose one hero with one villain from the same movie or the same franchise or in conflict with one another. So the front of the exhibit, we wanted to put some of these costumes right out near the front since it's such a draw, and you can see right from the cornerstone down this way. So we'll try to usually put something large here. We have the White Queen and the Red Queen in front of here from Alice in Wonderland. And this is one of those examples of the pods where there's a hero and a villain together. And over on the other side, we have Little Red Riding Hood and the Big Bad Wolf. And it gives a good sense of the exhibit as you're going. So as we come in, the experience is set up with Cinderella and the Fairy Godmother. We're going into the Cinderella Workshop, as I had mentioned before. So the characters here are Helena Bonham Carter on the left and Lily James on the right. Those are the actors. And so this is where you start thinking like, I didn't realize that this actor was that height. And that's also fun because you kind of get to know the actors a little bit through the costumes too. There are some sketches on the wall that have some of the costumes that are in the exhibit and then some that are not. Like I'd mentioned, there were some that the costumes just did not survive, and so this is a way that we can show that. So here we have some costumes from the 1960s, but also some that are much more recent, and this shows the design process that these costume creators went through.
It's really interesting to see all the sketches and to see the different starting points for these costumes.
Absolutely. And here we have Mary Poppins from the 60s and Mary Poppins from just a couple of years ago. And it's the same costume, but updated. So it still has her carpet bag and her traveling coat and her hat, but just a little bit of a different take on the same costume. With Cinderella, it seems like each generation may have their version of Cinderella. And I'll admit that this one is mine if we're going for live action, because this was the Brandy Cinderella, and then we have the Whitney Houston Fairy Godmother over there on the right. So this was really groundbreaking in its day. Back in the 90s, and I still remember it fondly. It's the Rodgers and Hammerstein musical version.
I've seen it myself, and it was such a great movie.
It really is.
It's really stunning to see these details so closely. That you, when you're watching it on film, you see some details, but seeing them up close, it's just another level of, you just don't realize how much goes into them.
Absolutely. Here's a perfect example. This is the Cinderella from Into the Woods, worn by Anna Kendrick. And we also have her shoes. And you would never notice those shoes in the film. It might be a fleeting thing that comes on the screen. But it has a bunch of like leaf motifs on it and gold. And it's really just stunning. More footwear over here. This is what goes into making a glass slipper. This was the glass slipper from the 2015 version of Cinderella. And there's different molds that were used as prototypes for this. This is the slipper when it's being held, not when it was actually on her foot. They did put it on her foot with CGI, but she was wearing different shoes. And there's Swarovski crystals on it, so it really picks up the light, and you can see the process.
Oh, yeah.
So iconic. This is where we start. The villains on the left and the heroes on the right. We have Lady Tremaine and Drizella and Anastasia, the wicked stepmother and stepsisters, on one side. And we have the princes on the right. So we do have some groupings, and these princes we thought that they could hang out together. So costuming for men as well as women. Thus far in the exhibit, we've only seen female costumes. And again, I think that male costuming sometimes doesn't get as much attention as women's costuming. I think there's just an allure of a big poofy dress and beadwork and such. But you look at the men's costuming and all the detail that goes into their epaulettes and their puffy sleeves and belts and such. Great to appreciate.
Oh, yeah, and you see it even on the simplest costumes, how much detail can actually be put in, like in the Dustain costume.
Mm-hmm. We've been doing some hands-on programming that we've been switching out every month because we want this exhibit to be fun and accessible to all ages, so we were able to achieve that. Here is an example. This is how we can use props to either help a hero of a film, or if we're talking about a villain, maybe we could diminish their chances of achieving their goals. So, we have popsicle sticks, and we would pull out one. Let's see, Captain Hook. So if we were trying to stop Captain Hook, we could take all of these parts, and what might we do for Captain Hook? Well, maybe we would design something that would pull his hook off of his arm, or we could trip him as he's going down the gangplank of his pirate ship. And these parts can be put together to do that in different creative ways.
Someone
can think of, they would be able to do that.
That's really fascinating, because I know that the museum has always been about innovating, and that's something that they've really been pushing forward, and to see that being brought into something like this is really interesting.
Well, thank you for saying that. Yeah, that is one of our goals, is to innovate, and in this case, we're creating something that would be an innovation, or at least an invention.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, I like going over by the villains because they have some really outlandish costumes. We could really stop at any of them. This is an interesting one. It's Red. He's the villain from Wrinkle in Time, which I actually remember as the book series I loved when I was a kid. And they made a made-for-TV movie in 2018 of this. And it's sort of hard to describe, but it's a very stiff sort of foam that his costume is made of, and it looks like a beach day jacket with lots of different colors, his socks and shoes too, but he is indeed an evil mastermind. So why this costuming was chosen, I don't know, but it calls some attention to his evilness. And one thing that I know a lot of people are thinking about, because the new Hocus Pocus 2 is about to be released, are the Sanderson sisters.
Yes.
They're probably one of our most popular adult costumes at our Halloween program. We have the original Winifred, Sarah, and Mary Sanderson costumes, along with Mary's vacuum on exhibit. So most photographed costumes would probably be these ones.
Yep, and now with the new movie coming out in a couple of days, really, this is probably going to be something that everybody is going to want to see.
Oh, I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's pop on over to the other side. Maleficent is part of our anti-heroes or spaces between This was worn by Angelina Jolie. So it's an evil character that we recognize, but we get a little bit of backstory on her. Her costume, though, certainly does look quite evil. She's got horns and a staff and a really, really starched collar.
It's interesting to see the blends of fabrics that they put in and where they strategically put those fabrics.
Yes, how each of those fabrics lays. Here's some more really awesome Wrinkle in Time costumes. These are the witches, and in this case, the witches are good, and they help the protagonists in this film. And each of these costumes is so different, and in some cases uses such unconventional materials, like on Oprah Winfrey's skirt of her dress. Another guest favorite is the original Mary Poppins 1964 traveling costume with her, the umbrella, the bird on it, and we also have the one from 2018 to go alongside it. Here's a great example of detail. This is Athena. She's the girl in Tomorrowland from 2015, which was a film that was created after the Disneyland area,
yes,
of Tomorrowland. They, in a flip of how they do that, kind of like the Jungle Cruise movie,
yes,
or Pirates of the Caribbean. This is Tomorrowland. And if you look at the details on her stripes, on her dress, it's actually math.
I was going to say, that is so fascinating, yeah, and cool just to see, mm-hmm, how much detail goes into these, and to see just something so small that from a distance or even on film you're not gonna see it.
Right.
But when you come here, you're gonna see just how much thought is put,
exactly,
into each one of these.
Yeah.
That is incredible.
So definitely get your phone out and magnify it. And if there are any math folks that are that are out there, feel free to email in and tell me what exactly this math is, if it has some deeper meaning, or is it just pretend math? Because I would not know the difference.
I don't think I would know either.
We have a number of Dumbo costumes. Again, it's a more recent film. This is from 2019. This exhibit had first appeared at the D23 Expo, which, if you're a Disney fan, that's their big yearly unveil of all the upcoming celebration of the past. And the Disney Archives always has a presence there. They brought Walt's plane this year, I think. So this exhibit first appeared there a couple of years ago, and then it moved on to another location, and Disney has the opportunity to switch out some of the costuming. So it has kept very much up to date. Emma Watson is another guest favorite from Belle in Beauty and the Beast in 2017. We have her ball gown. It is the iconic yellow, and then we have her village dress.
Sorry, I'm a little flabbergasted,
yes,
by just everything. So overwhelming your first time going through.
We were too the first time.
Yes, yeah, oh, we were. I envy some members of my team that are actually able to touch these things, but then that's a huge responsibility too.
Oh,
they're setting these up, and Disney is quite careful with all of their costumes, and they send send a full complement of staff to come and set up even the poses. They have to make sure that all the mannequins' poses are appropriate to the character. So just a fantastic level of detail. Becky Klein is the director of the Walt Disney Archives, and she came during the installation to tweak a little bit of that. But really the curators and collections folks that came are stellar.
Yeah, because that was actually going to be a question I was going to ask, was if Disney did have a hand, and it sounds like they have a very large hand in putting together.
Yeah, very much so. We created the layout,
mm-hmm,
and that can, with traveling exhibits, that can kind of go either way, but sometimes the lending entity will create the layout. Sometimes we will. In this mm-hmm. case, we did. But we had regular meetings with them to make sure that everything that we had laid out needed met what they needed. And then they were very hands-on with the installation. We provided the platforms and the walls, and they took care of all the mannequins. Most of the mannequins come dressed in their costumes already, but there is a need to make sure that everything is de-wrinkled and yes. that everything's looking its best when it goes on exhibit.
So I have to ask, is there a favorite part for you? Is mm-hmm. there a costume or a section that really just every time you come in here, you feel the need to come and at least peek at it?
Yeah. I would say the Wrinkle in Time costumes. Okay. I think the costumes are one of the best things about that film. Like I said, I did love the book series as a kid, so oftentimes when people will come in here, they will have a favorite, and it's usually something that caught their attention early on. So for me, it's that. I like particularly the dress that has the fabric, just the layers and layers of fabric,
yes.
and it almost looks like pages in a book. So I would say that's my favorite.
Awesome. Mm-hmm. And I know that I saw online that the Genius at Play store kind of turned into a Disney store. How is that
yes.
for you guys?
That's the Costumer's Vault is what we're calling the Genius at Play store right now. Retail is an important part of a museum experience nowadays, mm-hmm. and we wanted to make sure we had a large enough space to show that off. Sometimes we'll have small stores within an exhibit itself. In this case, we didn't have the space to do that, mm-hmm. and so we're trying out having Genius at Play be that space for us. So there was a whole transformation of signage in there, and all of the merch that's in that store right now is Disney related. It would be a great place to get a Halloween costume for kids, and there's t-shirts and mugs and just souvenirs too.
Now we turn to Mir News reporters Aliyah Mansour and Ali Sablini, who spoke with Jim Johnson, Director of Exhibits at Greenfield Village, who will speak about one of Greenfield Village's most popular attraction, Holiday Nights.
If we could just start by you sharing your name and your position.
It's Jim Johnson, and I'm the Director of Greenfield Village, but also the Curator of Historic Structures and Landscapes here at the Henry Ford.
Could you share the history of Holiday Nights at Greenfield Village?
Sure. It's actually kind of has a long lineage as far as us doing holiday programming here. And it goes back probably into the 1950s and 1960s when we would decorate buildings and do sort of special activities. It was mostly geared towards an evening, a daytime experience. But at some point along the way, probably about 40 years ago, an evening dining experience was added to that. So you would have dinner at one of the restaurants, including the Eagle Tavern, then the Clinton Inn, and then go out for a carriage ride and stop at a couple houses that were staffed for the evening. So that was kind of the foundation of that. Visitation started to shift. We'd gone through several iterations of what the daytime program was. It kind of drifted into kind of a lackadaisical period, and then we revived it a bit. But we experimented and really hoped to get a few hundred people to buy tickets and come in for the evening. So we sort of shifted what we were doing during the day to an evening format. We'd had some experience with that with the other format, and the expectations were just blown away as far as the demand. And then we went back to the drawing board, and actually a colleague of mine went off site. We had a little kind of mini meeting, a little retreat about, okay, how do we go to the next step? So we proposed some things, brought those back, worked with our marketing department, our programming department, and went all out as far as adding entertainment, adding fireworks, adding all kinds of stuff. And that was in the early 2000s. And we've been sort of on really a growth pattern ever since. The pandemic did a lot of damage to what we're able to do. We did in 2020 present a kind of restricted version of Holiday Night, where we didn't really go into buildings. We did some of the activities were not done, but still people were thrilled to be out. We kept capacities very low. So now we learned so much from the changes we were forced to make as far as how we approach the program, trying to cram people inside buildings. You know, we took a different approach to allowing people to see the interiors. And we looked at capacities, which during the up to 2019, we saw over 100,000 people come through Holiday Nights, which translated into sometimes 6,500 people a night, which at the peak was just a crush in the village. It was really too many people. So we've adjusted that capacity down quite a bit, and we sold the event out this year in 10 days. So no, there are no tickets left. It was just almost like a crazed, the members bought most of them, and some were available for the public. So anyway, the history of it goes back quite a ways, but really through the 2000s, through 2010s and now into the early 2020s is when really it came together as we know it today with all the components. We tweak everything every year so people recognize the familiar things they enjoy coming to see, but it's not the same every single year. So the decoration is a little different shows, different music, different things like that. But the core of the experience remains pretty steady.
Like it gets better and better each year.
I think so, yep. And we're working with more partners, people that specialize in certain time periods or different things they do. And we're bringing them in for not maybe every 18 night, but some of the nights as a kind of a, you know, surprise and delight for that particular night. So we're continuing to tweak with that. And the results are great. So, but the demand for the program now is just overwhelming. And we really don't have much room to grow. There aren't many more days in December that would make sense. But, we don't want to jack up capacity again because it reduces the guest experience.
Right. That's awesome.
Can I step in for a moment?
Yeah,
sure. So, Mr. Johnson, is there anything specific do you think like entices the people to come to the Holiday Nights every year? Or I know you guys switch things up every year, but like is just the experience in general, or is there something that people like you can tell that they enjoy?
I think it is. There's a certain level of sort of excitement and hubbub when you come into the village, especially in the Main Street area, but then it gets quieter and a little bit more sort of austere out further away from the center of village. I think it's a good escape for people because the modern holiday, which is not really a modern concept, the holidays have been a crazed thing for people for 150 years, as far as, you know, the shopping and the preparations, all that stuff. You know, people have been doing that for a long time. But the perception is that in today's world, it's just, you know, it's so hectic. And this is a way to step back, slow things down, and, experience the village after dark, which is really an extraordinary thing.
Okay, so one more thing. I know you said you don't have much room for growth because there aren't any other days you can expand to, but do you know if there's any other ways you can accommodate for more people so that more people may enjoy the experience? Or
we've talked about that, and we're still debating exactly, you know, what capacities really can be. We will be adding for the first time this year. We had it for a Halloween program, but the Central Market was this enormous new building that was added to Greenville Village just this year. We've had it in pieces here for over 20 years, and we finally managed to get the funding together just as the pandemic hit, but we are already funded. So we actually built it during the pandemic years. So it's an open pavilion, not great for December, but we've made some accommodations that maybe, you know, will work for us. And that's going to allow a little bit more capacity. And then in 2014, maybe the end of 13, we're looking to open a brand new restaurant, which is just across the street from the new Farmers Central Market, which also can help with capacity. Feeding people is an issue. You know, it's the experience is all about, as you go places, what you get to eat, what you get to buy, maybe to take away with you, and then what you get to see and do. So those are the things that we always keep in mind, and we want people to be able to enjoy themselves and have access to things. We actually saw that our per caps, which is what people spend per head, the average, goes up when they can access things. When it was so busy, people had to stand in line forever to get a donut. We didn't sell as many donuts. So there's something to be said for finding the right capacity level during your event to have it maximize, you know, financially for you.
I was wondering what some of the key attractions are at Holiday.
Sure. Yep. So there's combinations of different things. So it's quite a few of the buildings are open. There's staff with staff in period clothing, whatever time period it might be. They're doing activities. So that's one of the things people like to see, because each one represents a different geographic location, a different time period in history, and, you know, different kinds of things are done in each one. So it's kind of cool. But the musical performances and the musical offerings are substantial throughout the village. So that's another one included in your ticket. If you choose to get in line and do it, you can go on a Model T ride. The carousel is included in admission, and also a horse-drawn wagon ride with live music on it. Those are kind of some of the key components. We end the evening, which people really look forward to. A lot of people stay for this, is we have a live caroling event in front of Town Hall on the Village Green, hosted by Santa Claus, who comes, you know, in to greet everyone. And then we shoot fireworks to end the evening.
What has been changed or added to Holiday Nights this season?
So this year, as I said before, we always tweak the decorations. We do things a little bit different. This year, we are expanding some of the stories and perspectives, if you will, that we're trying to share with people. One of our sites is the Susquehanna Plantation, which comes to us from Southern Maryland. It was built probably before 1820, but we show around 1860, just before the Civil War began there. Southern Maryland was a heavily Catholic area, which meant, you know, those folks did decorate and did celebrate Christmas. The house was owned by the Carroll family, which was a very, very wealthy family. The house and its furnishings don't reflect that wealth. What reflected their wealth was the amount of land that they owned, which is several times the size of Greenville Village originally, and the number of enslaved people that they owned that ran the operation. So what we set up in there is preparations for a wedding banquet, a wedding feast, because Christmas was the wedding season in plantation society in Southern Maryland and other parts of the South. And we want to sort of share some of the perspectives of the enslaved people that really, you know, a big group of them did not get time off at Christmas because they were running the house and making all the parties happen and getting all the preparations done. So we've got a couple of dramatic programs that we're doing down there that will share that perspective with people. After they've seen the opulence of the house, then they can hear, you know, from the folks that really had to make all that happen and not by choice, you know. We are also adding a musical element to the Maddox House, which is a family, an African-American family owned this house also in southern Georgia near Savannah. And Christmas, we have some oral histories about what the family did at Christmas time. And we're going to be doing some musical things from the front porch of the Maddox House. So those are some of the new additions this year. And again, we tweak other things and kind of freshen stuff as we go around.
I want to know, like, about how many people attend Holiday Nights. I know you said, like, do you have a number specifically?
Yeah, we're sold out. So I think we're looking at close to 80,000 people will attend this year when it's all said and done. So our peak of visitation was well over 100,000 in 2019. But as I mentioned before, we've right-sized, I think, and gotten attended. So it's a little bit more enjoyable for people when they come out.
Is this through the whole month of December, or is it like the
18 nights? So we start on December 2nd, and we do a Friday, Saturday, Sunday combination up until, I think, the 15th or 16th. Then we do straight run all the way to the 23rd. Then we actually do three nights after Christmas, which we used to be soft, used to be kind of people are going to come. Those sold out. So, you know, because people are in town and they want stuff to do. So that's, you know, it turns out that, you know, Santa is missing. You know, there's no Santa Claus after Christmas because he's gone away. But everything else is going on at that point.
Mr. Johnson, what are your favorite attractions in the Holiday Nights?
It's hard to pick. Some of the things that we've done, they're kind of detailed things, but for instance, at the Wright Brothers home, that's one of the few places where we have actual documentation and actual photographic documentation of a Christmas thing that the Wright Brothers did in 1900, which is put up their very first Christmas tree. And we have a photo of it, probably taken by Orville Wright, in the parlor just before, you know, the all the nieces and nephews arrived for the day. And for the longest time, we had not good documentation. We eventually got a photograph of this Christmas tree, but it was a very fuzzy third generation type of thing. You know, this is, and we're talking before there was really good digitization and even the internet when we started doing this stuff. And about 10 years ago, we realized that the Library of Congress had digitized everything. And this actual photograph was in high resolution there, so you could look at it very clearly. And then another site called Sharpie, which is a website that specializes in old photography that they super digitize, you know, high resolution, had done this photograph, and not only done the photograph, but they had done high resolution scans of the ornaments on the tree and all the toys beneath the tree. So suddenly a whole world was opened up to us, and we were able to reproduce to the best of our ability the exact tree as it looked in 1900. So that was kind of a journey over time. And, you know, we've gotten to the point where it's just perfect now. And that's one of my favorite things, because it's like a time travel thing. Another thing is the story that we tell and present at Menlo Park. December has a lot of good connections for us. That's when Thomas Edison first demonstrated the electric light to the public on New Year's Eve of 1879. And then he did another big exhibition for the leadership of New York City in 1880 in December. And the Wright brothers flew in December of 1903. So there's a lot of sort of Christmas connections, but the Menlo story is great. The preparations that were underway for hosting the aldermen or the leaders in New York City at Menlo Park Laboratory. And we know a lot of information about that. And we've recreated that scene, including a banquet set up on the second floor that he surprised all the aldermen with, that was catered by a very famous restaurant in New York City in 1880. So we recreate that. And we had the pipe organ that's there on the second floor restored several years back. And we play that during the holiday nights too. So that's one of my favorites too. One, back to the Wright Home tree, in the fuzzy photograph we had is what appears to be a homemade angel. You know, it's about this big and it sits in the right in the center of the tree. You know, you couldn't really see any detail on it. So that, you know, that's interesting because a lot of people made homemade ornaments in that time period. Come to find out, as soon as we saw the resolution, the high-res photograph, we were blown away because it's a novelty paper doll of a crying, screaming baby and it's hanging right in the center of the tree. So that was some sort of inside family joke that we don't know, but we just thought that was hysterical, you know, and we thought a reproduction of the paper doll, and now it's front and center on the tree.
Another question I have is about how many people are involved with preparing holiday nights?
It's becomes the work of the organization. We have that going on in addition to all the sort of catered events and things that we do during the holiday season. So there's a whole team that manages that in addition to portions of holiday nights as far as the dinners and things like that goes. So it's literally hundreds of people that are involved in the actual final push to get holiday nights completed. So that means decorating the village, both the historic houses and all everything outside, putting up the lighting that we do. We use a lot of effect lighting to suggest lighting up the path. We don't do a lot of modern, you know, Christmas lights like you'd see on Heinz Drive or anything like that. The food team steps up and does a lot of sort of immersive, you know, street food setups. You know, walk up and buy all kinds of stuff on the street. So it's really literally hundreds of people. And once we start rolling with the program, we'll have over 100 presenters in period dress and different contractors in each night performing or presenting to the public. So my team works on holiday nights almost every month of the year as far as doing preparation, doing research, planning, and trying to get things done as early as we can. So then it's just a matter of, you know, getting it out and implementing it when the time comes.
So this event takes a lot of preparation.
It is, and it's a huge financially important for the organization as well. So, you know, the amount of stuff, you know, you hear about how Disney flips from holiday to holiday and the army of people that they have in to do it overnight. We certainly don't have that luxury. So as soon as our Halloween program wraps, we're simultaneously taking down Halloween, putting it away, and putting up the holiday program here.
So would you say this is like the biggest event of the year, or
Yes, it runs 18 nights and it's very large scale. It includes almost every aspect of Greenville Village. So I would say it's the largest scale event that we do.
And the workers, they are hired seasonally?
Some are. We have a small seasonal staff we brought on to help us with Halloween. The goal with that group is to find places for them on the permanent staff. You know, the seasonal work is kind of a tryout to see how they're going to, what they're best suited to do. So, but the rest is done by our part-time year-round presenter staff. And of course, it's led by our management team, you know, in the programs division.
I was wondering if someone had never been to Holiday Nights, is there anything that you would want them to expect?
It's at your own pace. The only really scheduled thing are some of the musical performances, but there's plenty to see. And then the fireworks go off at a certain time in the end. So it's really very open and very easy because you can do whatever you want at whatever pace that you want. It is primarily an outdoor event, so people need to prepare for that because the weather can be all sorts during December. But really, some of the highlights are really to check out the historic buildings and listen to the music and just enjoy the whole vibe of the village at the holiday season.
Just one more question on my end. I was just wondering, do students get a discount or is it like the...
I believe we do offer that kind of thing for our daytime stuff. I'm not sure how it translates into programming. I know members and staff get discounts and then the general public, you know, has the non-discounted rate. You know, at this point, you know, the tickets sold out in 10 days. So, you know, it's kind of a rush to be able to get tickets to this event now.
Thank you so much.
All right. Take care. Bye.
That was Aaliyah Mansour and Ali Sablini speaking with Jim Johnson, Director of Exhibits at Greenfield Village in Dearborn, Michigan. Check out the latest installment of the Mir News podcast we call Behind the Scenes, where we visit Belle Isle Park in Detroit. This is Catherine Warden. Thank you for listening.